government regulations, which were created to protect employees, are actually hurting them.
Regulation after regulation.
Until the government understands that they have to create an environment suitable for us to keep growing, we're going to stay in this recession a long time.
The federal government has blocked efforts to expand the ride-sharing.
The owners say the restaurant has succumbed to the crush of government regulations.
We have seen an unprecedented explosion of new regulatory activity.
$1.8 trillion. That's how much business
and bus companies to close.
I think there are outdated regulations that need to be changed. There is red tape that needs to be cut.
The regulations are...
There's a regulation that doesn't make any sense. Why do you keep...
Is this really the best we can do?
This is Free Lunch, the podcast of the Federalist Society's Regulatory Transparency Project. All expressions of opinion on this podcast are those of the speakers.
Good afternoon, everyone, and welcome to the 20th episode of the Federalist Society Free Lunch Podcast for the Regulatory Transparency Project. Visit the RTP website at regproject.org, regproject.org, to subscribe to our newsletter and to follow us on Facebook, Twitter, and LinkedIn. My name is Devin Westhill. I'm the director of the RTP and the host of the Free Lunch Podcast. This Free Lunch Podcast is a bit of an update from one we had in July of last year with Wayne Cruz of the Competitive Enterprise Institute on regulatory dark matter. That is, the thousands of executive branch and federal agency proclamations and issuances, including guidance documents, memoranda, bulletins, circulars, letters, and even FAQs that carry practical, if not always technically, legally binding regulatory effect. This call will focus on agency guidance, the development of it, proper and improper use, and recent developments related to the use of guidance over the last year. Here to discuss this topic are our Free Lunch Podcast guests, Paul R. Noe and Stephen Cox. Paul serves as Vice President of Public Policy for the American Forest and Paper Association. Paul has extensive regulatory and legislative experience in both the private and public sectors. Between 2001 and 2006, Paul served as counselor to the administrator in the Office of Information and Regulatory Affairs, Office of Management and Budget. There, he helped to lead the development of regulatory policy and White House review of regulations. And before that, Paul served as senior counsel to the U.S. Senate Committee on Governmental Affairs, where his work focused on reforming the regulatory process. Steve serves as Deputy Associate Attorney General at the Department of Justice, where he manages a broad range of law enforcement, civil justice, grant making, and regulatory issues. He handles commercial litigation, including False Claims Act enforcement, and he serves as the Executive Director of the Department's Regulatory Reform Task Force. Like Paul, Steve has a diverse legal career in both public service and the private sector, most recently as corporate counsel for Apache Corporation. Okay, in just a minute, I'm going to turn the floor over to Paul. Before I do, I want to remind everyone on the call that the Federalist Society takes no position on particular legal or public policy initiatives, and therefore all expressions of opinion on Free Lunch Podcasts are those of our featured speakers. Also, Paul and Steve will take questions after their remarks, so please be prepared with any questions that you might have prior to the start of our question and answer period. Paul and Steve, thanks so much for joining us today as our Free Lunch Podcast guests. Paul, you have the floor.
Thank you, Devin. I appreciate the opportunity to participate on today's webinar. I want to thank the Federalist Society and you for making that happen, and appreciate the opportunity to be here with Steve, who's done great work on guidance at the Department of Justice. Let me start by saying that I'm speaking today in my personal capacity, so any mistakes I make are my own. And certainly, while agency development and use of guidance documents can be an eye-glazing subject, it's nonetheless very important. Guidance, the full spectrum of policy statements and interpretive rules, is a vast but often mysterious part of the administrative law universe, what Wayne Cruz at the Competitive Enterprise Institute has called regulatory dark matter. He explains that astrophysicists have concluded that ordinary visible matter in our galaxies and the multitudes of galaxies beyond our own only comprise about 5% of our universe. Instead, dark matter and dark energy make most of the universe, rendering the bulk of existence beyond our ability to directly observe. Likewise, we know that the totality of guidance documents is enormous, in both numbers and sheer tonnage, orders of magnitude beyond regulations, which lawyers know as legislative rules. But in truth, nobody actually knows how many guidance documents there are or how to find them all. And they are rendered all the more mysterious by the lack of meaningful due process and management. Before I dive into the challenges posed by guidance, I do want to start with the acknowledgement that guidance can and often does play a critical and beneficial role in regulatory programs. When properly used, guidance can reasonably channel the discretion of agency employees, provide the public clear notice of the line between permissible and impermissible conduct, and ensure equal treatment of similarly situated parties, and that's all to the good. Unfortunately, many concerns have been raised that agency guidance practices should be better managed and be more transparent, consistent, and accountable. There's also growing concern that in some instances, guidance documents are being used in lieu of regulations without observing the procedural safeguards required for regulations. The D.C. Circuit bluntly stated it as follows. The phenomenon we see in this case is familiar. Congress passes a broadly worded statute. The agency follows with regulations containing broad language, open-ended phrases, ambiguous standards, and the like. Then as years pass, the agency issues circulars or guidance or memoranda, explaining, interpreting, defining, and often expanding the commands and regulations. One guidance may yield another, and then another, and so on. Law is made without notice and comment, without public participation, and without publication in the Federal Register or the Code of Regulations. Problematic guidance has multiple dimensions. There can be regulation by guidance, which is the problem flagged by the D.C. Circuit, what Professor Bob Anthony has called spurious rules. So these are rules that should have been but were not promulgated through notice and comment as legislative rules consistent with the Administrative Procedure Act. There's also, though, coercive guidance. For example, guidance that might give preferential treatment, maybe fast-track treatment, for example, to a regulated entity if they take one course of action and knowing they'll face disfavored treatment if they take any other course of action that's otherwise lawful. Another example might be government pronouncements that can cause reputational harm about a product or a substance on the marketplace. There's also the issue that process should be due not just as a matter of law in many cases, but as a matter of good government, as a matter of fairness and transparency or providing needed information, even if we're not dealing with a rule that is legally required to undergo notice and comment by the APA. There's also the benefits that can come from better management and interagency coordination on the development of guidance. All of these factors have to be considered. They ought to all be addressed while bearing in mind that these concerns should be addressed without unduly ossifying the rulemaking process. But in my view, there's a solution here, which is the executive branch should refocus on good guidance practices. There's certainly been work in this area in the past. We have had a well-established process for the centralized review of legislative rules coordinated by OMB for 37 years, but that process, unfortunately, has been very deficient when it comes to agency guidance. It goes all the way back to the executive order issued by President Reagan in 1981, which governed OMB review on its face of all rules, and that included not just legislative rules, but interpretive rules and policy statements. But then in 1993, President Clinton issued a successor to that order and rescinded the Reagan order. But his order only covered rules the agency intends to have the force and effect of law, so it neglected guidance documents. When I worked for President George W. Bush, I was at OMB and worked on a process to bring in guidance for OMB review. We had an amendment to the Clinton executive order that had some basic procedures. First, the agency would have to provide OMB with advance notice of significant guidance. And if asked by OMB, the agency would have to provide a copy of the guidance and a brief explanation of its need. This was a streamlined procedure, more streamlined than to use for significant regulations. The burden would be on OMB to bring in for review what it needed. But it set up basic rules of the road between the agencies and OMB. And this executive order was supplemented by an OMB bulletin for good guidance practices that I worked on. And it had some basic good government provisions. Number one, agency procedures for the approval and use of significant guidance documents by appropriate senior agency officials, and direction that agency employees shouldn't depart from their guidance without appropriate justification and supervisory concurrence. It also required standard elements in guidance. For example, agencies were directed to avoid inappropriate mandatory language. And third, it had public access and feedback procedures. This included the public's ability to see and access guidance documents in one convenient place, and also a presumption that there'd be pre-adoption notice and comment, at least for the most important economically significant guidance. These provisions in the bulletin and the executive order were consistent with recommendations from the Administrative Conference of the United States and the American Bar Association. Unfortunately, when President Obama came into office, while he did leave the bulletin in place, he rescinded the Bush executive order amendments. They put a memo in place that said guidance documents would remain subject to OMB review, but my understanding is that that practice was disorganized, ad hoc, and little used, which isn't surprising because there was no real written authority for the practice and no real procedures governing review before the Bush amendment. The basic problem is an OIRA desk officer would have to already know that the agency guidance existed in order to request a copy of it, and they also had to get permission from the agency staff to bring it in, and they often felt that OMB had no business asking for their guidance without explicit authority. So not a good way to run a railroad, and in fact, I know from experience there were cases when OIRA desk officers did not know about a guidance before it was issued and might find out about it for the first time from a story in the Washington Post. So that's a fundamental problem that I think is going to remain a challenge unless and until there's more clear procedures here. Also, I have to say I'm very disappointed as someone who put time into working on the bulletin that there's been gross agency noncompliance with it. That has been shown by congressional oversight by Senator Lankford and others in both the Senate and House. And in addition, there was a Government Accountability Office investigation of compliance with the bulletin. GAO looked at four major departments of government, departments of agriculture, education, health and human services, and labor. And they found that those departments and their component agencies in general had a long track record of failing to comply with basic good government requirements in the bulletin. So it's evident that more has to be done here, which is why I applaud what the Department of Justice is doing. But I have a few thoughts to share on what could be done on a government-wide basis. First, I believe OMB should have procedures for the agencies to inform it, and so it can also inform other agencies about the development of important guidance documents, and so they can coordinate with other interested agencies, receive input, and be transparent about it. This wouldn't necessarily have to be done by executive order as was done by George W. Bush, but certainly basic procedures are needed for OMB and other agencies to get a heads up about what's going on, and the resources should be provided to do the job right. Secondly, the agency should follow the recommendations of the Administrative Conference of the United States and the ABA to provide streamlined pre-adoption notice and comment for significant guidance, not just economically significant guidance as the bulletin did. In other words, I'm calling for tightening the bulletin. And the reason for that is the GAO report and other oversight has shown that the agencies have done an end run around the bulletin, and they claim that none of their guidance fits that definition. I will say there are good examples to point to here in the federal government. The FDA had, even prior to OMB, developed their own good guidance practices. Congress liked it so much they codified the requirement to do that in the FDA Modernization Act of 2000. And my understanding is that the practice has been successful and is respected by stakeholders and includes wide use of pre-adoption notice and comment for guidance documents. If this problem isn't focused on by OMB, my concern would be it could actually undermine OMB's authority to review regulations. And the dysfunction is parallel to what the D.C. Circuit observed in the quote I provided from its Appalachian Power decision. So in other words, the agency could issue broad, open-ended legislative rules that pass through interagency review, and for that matter, through court review or even congressional review. But then the agency could follow with guidance expanding the commands and the regulations to agree that would have raised concerns and potentially been changed if those details had appeared in the regulations from the start. So I think if the executive branch does not step in, the resolution of the problem inevitably will shift elsewhere to Congress or to the courts. And in fact, there are a number of proposals in Congress on this issue, including the Truth in Regulations Act by Senator Lankford that would codify and strengthen the OMB bulletin, and a very recent bill introduced by Senator Ron Johnson called the Guidance Out of Darkness Act, which would establish some basic transparency and publication requirements for guidance on the Internet. If this problem isn't addressed, then we're likely to have further intervention by Congress or the courts in the spurious rule case law and in the reconsideration of our deference, providing deference to agency interpretations of their regulations. And with that, Devin, I'll stop there.
Wonderful. Thanks, Paul. Why don't we go ahead and just hand this off now to Steve. Steve?
All right. Well, thanks, Devin, and thanks, Paul. I really appreciate you all arranging this call. Thanks to the Federalist Society, and thanks to everybody who took time to dial in. As Devin mentioned, I'm Stephen Cox, and I'm a Deputy Associate Attorney General of the Department of Justice. And I'm happy to chat with all of you about what we're doing on this front in the sort of regulatory guidance space. As I'm sure everybody on the phone is aware, one of the highest priorities of the administration is regulatory reform, and that effort is really happening at agencies across the administration. It was a little less than a year ago, maybe March 1, that the president signed Executive Order 13777 that required each agency to set up its own regulatory reform task force. The Attorney General's task force is led by Rachel Brand, the Associate Attorney General, and I've been supporting her on that front since the get-go. I think she was sworn in late May of last year, and we held our first reg reform task force meeting within a couple of days of that. What most folks are aware is that each of the reg reform task force is evaluating their sort of central mission is to evaluate existing regulations and looking for candidates for repeal, replacement, or modification with an eye toward reducing unnecessary regulatory burdens on the public. What I think is probably less known is that the way that the executive orders define regulations, it actually is very broad and includes, in our view, the issue of regulatory guidance documents. And so we're taking a look at that, as are other reg reform task forces throughout the agencies. And like other task forces at the Department of Justice, we're also looking at improving the regulatory process overall with the same goal in mind of reducing unnecessary burdens on the public, but also with a focus on adhering to the rule of law and the relevant process that governs the rulemaking. Adam White has a new piece that some of you may have seen on the first year of reg reform, and I think what he calls this is sort of reform from the bottom. The idea is that when agencies unilaterally adopt reforms to promote regulatory transparency and accountability, these reforms can be seen as the equivalent of best practices. They're noticed by judges, they're noticed by legislators, and they raise the bar for what we expect of other agencies. And he even writes that even minor changes that improve the procedural rigor of rulemaking can long outlive the more prominent work that might be featured on the headlines. And these reforms from the bottom, can be building blocks for future reforms and even future legislation. And given the role that the Department of Justice plays in the administration in defending the rule of law, we want to lead by example and serve as a model for other agencies, to be sure. And one of the first areas of reform that we identified and examined relates to the issue of guidance documents. As this audience understands very well, and as Paul just talked about, when an agency has statutory authority to regulate and seeks to create or alter rights and obligations that are binding on the public or on the agency, the proper way to exercise that authority is normally through the rulemaking process governed by the Administrative Procedure Act, as well as other applicable laws and various executive orders and OMB rules. Rulemaking, as this audience understands, can be cumbersome and slow. Some probably would prefer it to be more cumbersome and slower. But what happens is that because of that process, sometimes agencies, including the Department of Justice in the past, have issued guidance documents to effectively make rules when they should have undertaken notice and comment rulemaking instead. That's the inappropriate side of guidance. And of course, as Paul mentioned, there's a flip side of guidance, the sort of the appropriate way to use guidance. And Paul articulated that very well. We think of it as when the department or an agency desires merely to educate regulated parties about the law. This is certainly, a way to give clear notice of what is permitted and what is not permitted. Indeed, there are statutory mandates to provide such guidance in some cases. For example, the Small Business Regulatory Enforcement Fairness Act requires agencies to publish compliance guides using plain language that's likely to be understood by small businesses. The Americans with Disabilities Act, for example, which is our Civil Rights Division here at the Department of Justice has authority to enforce that statute and promulgate regs under that statute. That law contains a technical assistance mandate that requires issuing guidance and technical assistance to the regulated community explaining the law and the sort of new regulations that are promulgated. And with this in mind, sort of the two sides of guidance, the appropriate side and sort of the improper side, the Attorney General recently announced in November, some of you were there, a new policy governing the Department of Justice's issuance of guidance documents. And I'll just sort of summarize what that policy does. It forbids the Department of Justice components from issuing guidance documents that effectively impose new obligations on the public. The Department of Justice is now prohibited from using guidance documents to create binding standards by which the department would determine compliance with existing regulations or statutes. And the department is prohibited from using guidance for the purpose of coercing persons into taking any action or refraining from taking any action beyond what is required by existing law. The policy also requires for new guidance documents that are coming out, sort of appropriate guidance documents, that they contain certain express disclaimers about what they are and what they are not. You can think of these disclaimers as sort of internal controls that will help the department avoid circumventing the policy and circumventing the rulemaking process. For example, new guidance has to disclaim any force or effect of law. It has to avoid language suggesting that the public has obligations that go beyond those set forth in existing law. Mandatory language is only allowed when restating clear mandates that are contained in existing statutes or regulations. This is a theme that we borrowed from the OMB bulletin that Paul just discussed, and we require when when we do that in a guidance document, that there need to be citations to those existing mandates. To the extent guidance contains voluntary or recommended practices, some call them best practices and whatnot, we require that those documents would have to clearly state that compliance with those practices is voluntary, and that non-compliance wouldn't result in an enforcement action, for example. Finally, the new policy requires consultation with the Office of Legal Policy at the Department of Justice before issuing any guidance. This is a further internal control to avoid circumvention of these principles, because our Office of Legal Policy is really studied on the issues not only contained in case law and what the D.C. Circuit has said on these issues, but also in the OMB bulletin, and so they can stand as a gatekeeper for this policy. We think these measures promote transparency, accountability, and rule of law, and we also think they will help change the regulatory culture at the department. And we hope, of course, that they change things at other agencies too. Obviously, our own regulatory policies only apply to the Department of Justice, but we're trying to lead by example. And I think people are noticing, and I'm happy to participate in this call about the issue. One more thing that I'll discuss is that about a month after the Attorney General announced the new policy, in which he had directed the Associate Attorney General to work with our components and our reg reform task force to identify existing guidance documents that should be repealed, replaced, or modified as part of our reg reform task force effort. About a month after the announcement, we announced our first tranche of guidance documents that we were rescinding. The subject matter of the documents runs the gamut, but is less important than the fact that these documents were rescinded because they were outdated, unnecessary, or inconsistent with or going beyond requirements of current law. Just to give you sort of some high-level examples, for example, one guidance document was from 1985. I think it came out of the ATF, which governs enforces the Gun Control Act and other firearms and explosive laws. The guidance document had interpreted the Gun Control Act as it then existed at the time, and said that certain interstate gun sales were prohibited. But then the law was amended the very next year to authorize the very gun sales, kinds of gun sales that the guidance document had said were prohibited. Yet the guidance document remained on the books and essentially misstated existing law for 30 some odd years. Some guidance documents that we rescinded interpreted or explained the Americans with Disabilities Act from a decade or two ago. But again, when the ADA regulations were amended a few years ago in 2010, the guidance documents became out of sync and yet remained unchanged, and therefore just misstated the state of existing law. Another example was a letter that was sent out to state and local jurisdictions and state and local courts about fines, fees, and bail. It was based on case law about the 14th Amendment, and it described requirements that went further than what is actually required under existing law. Again, the subject matter of the rescinded guidance documents that we announced recently is less important than the principle, which is that guidance documents that are inconsistent with existing law, whether it's because they're outdated or whether it's because they were designed to push the law in a certain direction, these documents can add confusion and can sometimes effectively add requirements on the public that go beyond what the law actually requires. And I expect we'll continue to look for existing guidance documents as part of the Reg Reform Task Force effort, which is ongoing, to rescind more documents in the months to come. And finally, we're continuing to look at this area and other areas in reg reform as opportunities for us to sort of reform things from the bottom up. And we'll continue to try to lead by example here at the Department of Justice. And with that, I will turn it back over to Devin. And I'm happy, I'm sure Paul is happy as well, to field or dodge any questions that you might have.
Awesome, Steve. Thanks. And you're welcome to field or dodge. So at this time, we'll go to audience questions. In a moment, everyone on the call is going to hear a prompt indicating that the floor mode's been turned on. After that, to request the floor, enter star, and then pound on your telephone keypad. I will open the floor now. Okay, the floor mode is on now. When we get to your request, you'll hear a prompt, and then you can ask your question. We'll answer all the questions in the order in which they're received. Again, to ask a question, just enter star and then pound on your telephone keypad. As we allow those questions to hit the queue, I have three announcements on this call. Bear with me. I want to go through two of them right now. I ask everyone on the call to mark your calendars because next week, Wednesday, January 31st at 12 o'clock noon, we'll have a free lunch podcast on the topic of regulating the transmission of money. Presently, money transmitters must go regulator to regulator, explain their business, and become licensed in 53 states and territories. Our podcast guest will be Peter von Valkenburg of the Coin Center. He'll discuss its regulatory structure and share his thoughts on establishing a federal alternative. Again, that's exactly 1 week from today, next week, Wednesday. My second announcement before we get to our first question is that next week, on Friday, February 2nd, the RTP is co-sponsoring the 14th Annual Symposium of the Journal of Law, Economics, and Policy on the topic of regulatory reform, transparency, and the American economy. That is at the George Mason University Antonin Scalia Law School from 8 a.m. to 6:30 p.m. It's open to the public and the media. The symposium will feature papers written by RTP experts such as Chuck Cooper, Boyden Gray, Adam White, who Steve referenced in his remarks, and will be keynoted by Philip K. Howard. You can register for free at the Law and Economics Center at the George Mason University website. Okay, now let's get to questions. Again, if you have a question, enter star and then pound on your telephone keypad, and we'll get to you in turn.
Hi, this is Devin Watkins from the Competitive Enterprise Institute. I was wondering, do you think it would be worthwhile if there was like a regulation passed through notice and comment that explicitly said that all these guidance documents do not have the force of law and should not be deferred at all by the courts?
Is that one, I think, Steve? But Paul, you may
have. This is Steve. I may actually, I think the concept is very interesting. Because I'm sort of speaking on behalf of the department, I want to get ahead of the department on something that we haven't fully considered and whatnot. So I may punt on that one to Paul to discuss from his perspective, if that's all right.
You know, I guess one question I have, it's kind of back to the questioner, but do you think that would give some sort of right to challenge spurious rules that doesn't already exist under the APA? That would be my question. I mean, I certainly am 100% for directives from the executive branch to employees to not coerce persons or entities with guidance. DOJ, in my mind, gets an A+ for that. And to be very clear that guidance does not have any force or effect of law and that they should be very clear on that. So let me just kind of say that up front. I had never thought about sort of doing it through a legislative rule, and I'd just be curious as to what statute you would be thinking of doing that under and whether that would enhance any rights to challenge spurious rules that doesn't already exist under the case law in the APA.
Well,
Devin, you've been hit the Socratic method.
So what I was thinking is that the various places where it says, you know, the agency shall have the authority to make rules or and that the general rulemaking for all the statutes that they have to enforce, they could probably make such a rule. And it would be mainly, I would think, a defense so that if an agency in the future comes after them for violating some statute and then relies on a guidance document to interpret such a regulation that the user could then raise that as a defense to say, no, you can't rely upon this guidance document. Here's this rule that was put out under notice of comment.
So I find that very intriguing. And, you know, since I'm speaking in my personal capacity, I can be on the provocative side. And I'd say I think it's that's an idea worth pursuing.
Thanks for the question, Devin, and thanks, Paul. And Steve, maybe on the next one you'll want to actually be the receiver. So let's see. Caller, when we get to your question, you can ask it.
Hello, my name is John Tuttle. I'm with the Michigan Attorney General's Office, and I would just like to second the previous gentleman's call for some rule legislatively that would clarify that guidance documents don't have the force of law, because I think it would do a good job of correcting erroneous judicial decisions that have since relied on these guidance documents. I'm thinking in particular ADA decisions from various courts who have relied on the DOJ and the DOT, Department of Transportation's, guidance documents to impose a kind of strict liability when it comes to road construction. And full disclosure, I'm currently involved in a couple of cases against the state of Michigan Department of Transportation involved in this. But what I found is that there's a number of decisions out there that really hinge almost completely on DOJ guidance and DOT guidance. And you get conflicting guidance when you actually attend a training session by the Federal Highway Administration. So I have personally sat in a training session of the Federal Highway Administration that has said, no, you know, these things don't, you're not required to apply these standards, but you have to have some standard. And the Federal Highway Administration has actually approved the Michigan Department of Transportation standards. Yet when you go to court, the judges will point to previous rulings and say, but this ruling here says you have to use this standard, and I'm following that precedent. And, of course, when you look at that precedent, it's based entirely on the DOJ, DOT technical guidance. So I think it would have very strong application in correcting the rule or in fostering the rule of law and the proper role of the courts if such a legislative solution was used. So that's all I'd like to say.
Well, Steve, I'm not going to make you punt on this one. Paul, do you have any reaction?
only that I think this is already a successful webinar, Devin, because I think these two commenters have raised great points, and I find them compelling.
Awesome. I know we have at least one other question queued up here, but I'm going to make another call to the audience. If you have a question, just enter star and then pound on your telephone keypad, and we'll keep this podcast great. I'll make one other announcement that I have before we get to our next question, and that is, again, mark your calendars, because on Thursday, February 8th at 12 o'clock noon, we're going to hold another free lunch podcast with Naomi Rao, the current administrator of the Office of Information and Regulatory Affairs. Administrator Rao will reflect on the performance of regulatory agencies over the past year and give her thoughts on what we might expect going forward. I don't expect she'll have anything bad to say about Department of Justice. Okay, caller, when we get to your question, you can ask it.
David Emerson with the Berkeley Federalist Society chapter. I'd like to get the speaker's reaction to a somewhat different form of guidance. It's a little bit firmer than what you've discussed, but still one that I come across constantly in my practice. And that is that, well, there's a few different types of it. One is, for example, the no action letter. The SEC is fond of using that approach rather than regulating directly. And some of these no action letters over a period of time become effectively the law in the area. Although at any time the SEC can narrow them and limit them or override them with no process whatsoever. It makes practice, it's much more difficult without knowing what the law actually is and knowing that it could be moved so quickly. And the no action letters are not actually particularly well reasoned because they're evidenced on just one set of facts. The IRS also has its private letter rulings, which are a bit of a counterpart to that, where, again, it's the same issue. The letter rulings, after a while, they become cited and they become effectively part of the body of law without any process behind them. And then there's safe harbors, which in many cases, because the actual statutes and regulations are so difficult to interpret, safe harbors are promulgated, which become de facto law. So in each of those cases, I'd like to get a sense of what the speakers think about that, whether it's something that we need to sunset or at least put a limit on how long there can be reliance on a no-action letter before an agency takes action and codifies it into something which is a bit more concrete and runs through a normal process.
Great. Thank you for the question. I feel compelled to give Paul the start here.
Yes, Devin, I'm happy to start here. This is going to be one where Steve may have to take a pass. But and let me just first say, I don't have expertise in the SEC or the IRS, but the kinds of things you're listing kind of follow a general pattern. And I think what you're uncovering is that, you know, anytime we're talking about guidance, we often talk about those few cases that wind up, in percentage terms, few cases that end up in the courts where a agency is challenged and has a guidance, a purported guidance, overturned as being a spurious rule that should have gone through legislative rulemaking procedures. And those are rare for all the reasons you understand full well, that, you know, parties don't want to be sideways with the agency. There's a tremendous expense and risk involved with the litigation and that sort of thing. But further down under the waterline, there's the use of guidance, as the D.C. Circuit said, to essentially make law without appropriate due process. And that's of great concern and why I would like to see more emphasis by the agencies in, you know, using notice and comment, using greater transparency and due process for developing their policy through regulation, as I think was contemplated when these due process provisions were created in the Administrative Procedure Act and in other statutes. So, you know, the Administrative Conference of the United States came out with a recent recommendation on agency development of guidance through policy statements, and I think it has a lot of favorable recommendations in it. I think a number of those are consistent with provisions in the Department of Justice memorandum that Steve has been talking about. But I have to say, this is one of the rare times that I've been disappointed in the Administrative Conference, because they pulled up short from applying these recommendations equally to interpretive rules as they were applied to policy statements. And apparently, one of the things that hung things up was a disagreement as to whether interpretive rules can be binding in a sense that policy statements can't be. And that, to me, is disturbing, that there wasn't an ability to gain consensus that these basic due process and transparency requirements should apply to guidance. And I really agree with the thrust of the caller's question that we shouldn't have a situation here where essentially laws created through individual private letter rulings or no action letters, or where an agency essentially compels a particular form of compliance through a safe harbor, when you know full well if you don't do what the agency's pointing you to, you're at great risk. And that just shouldn't be how the administrative state is administered. So I do hope, given the administration's great interest in regulatory reform, that they do more in this area of guidance and good guidance practices.
Well, thanks for the question and great response, Paul. Steve, should we go on to the next question?
I'll just make a brief comment. First of all, I think the caller brings up some excellent points. I think that I know that ACUS, when they were working on deciding what was in and what was out, in guidance documents really, is a term that we're all familiar with, but you know, there are many, many different kinds of guidance documents and how they fall into the spectrum of whether it's policy statement or an interpretive rule is sometimes a judgment call that's based on the particulars. I know for our The Department of Justice, when we defined what guidance documents we are talking about, we defined it as any DOJ statement of general applicability and future effect, whether it's styled as guidance or styled as something else, that are designed to advise parties outside the federal executive branch about legal rights and obligations. So we paint with a fairly broad brush, but we do carve out a few things that we are not really touching. And so, for example, we are not applying this to sort of binding adjudicatory actions, for example. And we define that as sort of adjudicatory actions that don't have the aim or the effect of binding anyone beyond the parties involved. So if you had a statement of particular applicability based on a particular party's questions about particular facts and the application of the law, that really didn't have the effect of, you know, sending a signal to the whole regulated community about what's accepted, what's not, what's permitted, what's not, then we would not call that a statement of general applicability or a guidance document under this memo, even though you might have an argument that that it fits in there within the auspices of the Administrative Procedure Act. And so we do have to draw a line somewhere, but it can be difficult. These can be difficult questions to answer. And what we're finding after we announce the policy is that our components are bringing the questions that they have to us, and so that we can make a much more informed decision and really drill down and say, what are you trying to do? What is it that you're trying to address, and why is this necessary? And then we can make an informed decision as to whether it falls within the policy or whether it's expressly carved out.
Great. Again, thanks for the question and great responses, Paul and Steve. If anyone on the call has a question, you just enter star and then the pound button on your telephone keypad, and we'll get to you. We're going to go to the next question in the queue. Caller, when we get to you, you can ask your question.
This is T.L. Cubbage. I practice law in Washington, D.C. Much of our discussion has focused on policies and practices that will diminish the government's ability to enforce so-called spurious law. But one context in which these guidances, these supposedly non-binding materials come into play can be in civil litigation in which no government agency is a party. For example, private litigants in the ERISA arena, the civil rights arena, environmental matters, might cite them. And in some instances, such parties have access to, either through their counsel or members of their organizations, guidances issued by prior administrations. And so do you have any thoughts on how to address the issue of this spurious law being proffered to courts in a context in which the federal government itself is not before the court?
This is Steve. Before I punt, I'll just make a couple of comments. I think this is it's an excellent question, because in practice, this is what happens. Sometimes this is how non-binding guidance documents become sort of converted into binding law when a court cites it, relies on it, makes it law, at least within that court's jurisdiction. I think that what we're trying to do, or what we have done so far at the DOJ, is really try to rein in the extent to which we issue the kind of guidance documents that really does go further than the law. And so that is our shot across the bow and what we're doing on our own. But obviously we cannot prevent other agencies from issuing guidance or other courts from relying on old guidance that has not yet been rescinded or modified.
I think it's a great question that TL asks, and I frankly hadn't thought about it a lot when I was working on the OMB bulletin, but I'll just throw a comment out there for people to think about, and Steve certainly doesn't have to answer it to it, but I just think that maybe the executive branch, in addition to some of the points I raised earlier, ought to be thinking about this and whether they need greater clarity about not only how guidance are to be used by their staff, but how they intend them to be used by the courts.
Thanks for the question. Thanks for the answer. I'm going to make one final call for questions before we let Paul and Steve go. Perhaps Paul and Steve have some final remarks as well, but if you have a question, please enter star and then pound on your telephone keypad, and we'll get to your question before we end the call today. Okay. Doesn't look like we have any more questions in the queue. Paul,
if we have a few minutes now, Devin, I add a couple points? I sort of saved this in case people wanted to ask more about it, but let me give a little bit more information about the non-compliance with the OMB bulletin, which concerns me. The GAO report I referenced that looked at four major departments, USDA, Education, HHS, and DOL, found that all of the components over this time period claim they did not issue any significant, economically significant guidance, which was the trigger for pre-adoption notice and comment. So that's not working at all. It's just being completely evaded. Only six of the 25 component agencies had written procedures to ensure consistent application of guidance. So that's really bad. We're talking about a bulletin that's been in place for about a decade or so. The HHS had no written procedures for approval of significant guidance at the departmental level. The Department of Labor procedures weren't available to its own staff. Nearly half the component agencies, and this is 25 again, did not regularly evaluate whether their issued guidance remained effective. And HHS at the departmental level wasn't posting significant guidance on their website as required by the OMB bulletin. Public access to guidance was hindered by being dispersed among multiple web pages, and many of the component agencies did not use metrics to improve how they disseminated guidance to their website. So I think that's a pretty stark record of noncompliance. So I'm pleased that the administration is very interested in this issue. I applaud what the Justice Department does, and I just hope that kind of initiative can be embraced on an administration-wide level.
Great, Paul, and thanks for that. Steve, do you have any final remarks you'd like to make?
Yeah, no, I really appreciate the opportunity to talk about this issue, and I think these are great conversations. It gives us other ideas to really think about and consider, and I know I'll be taking some of these things back and really chewing on some of that. I think to reiterate something that Paul just said, there's a reason that we call this sort of regulatory dark matter, is because it's really hard to identify. There was a Weekly Standard article that came out within the last couple of weeks by Terry Eastland, who talked a little bit about what we've done over at the Department of Justice, and he had a line in there about how there may be thousands of guidance documents in government storage. And my thought initially was, I wish it were that easy so that we would know where to go to find these guidance documents. But sometimes they go out into the ether, and you're not even sure where it is. I think we came across a guidance document that had been repealed beforehand, but still sort of existed on some orphan web page that we were able to find, and then obviously pull it down. But the guidance documents are out there. It's very hard to know what the complete universe is. In fact, I think there's a great opinion from the Tenth Circuit Judge Gorsuch talked about one agency's guidance documents. There were
37,000 of them on the website with a disclaimer that this is not a complete universe. And so that's the universe that we live in today. But and we're happy to do our part in trying to make marginal improvements here and try to reform from the bottom and see if we can come up with some best practices for other agencies to follow or at least to consider. And thanks again for having the call. I enjoyed it, and thanks for going easy on me with the questions.
We have a terrific audience, Steve, and great final remarks, Paul and Steve. I want to remind everyone on the call that if you're interested in hearing more about what we're interested in here with the Regulatory Transparency Project, join us next week for our next podcast. Perhaps we'll see you in person next week, Friday, at the Journal of Law, Economics, and Policy Symposium at George Mason Antonin Scalia Law School. If you're there, say hello. Or perhaps you want to join when we have Administrator Naomi Rao for a free lunch podcast on February 8th at 12 o'clock noon. In any case, mark your calendars. On behalf of the Federalist Society's Regulatory Transparency Project, I want to thank you, our audience, and of course, Paul and Steve, for joining us on the 20th episode of the Free Lunch Podcast today. Until we see you next time, so long.
On behalf of the Federalist Society's Regulatory Transparency Project, thanks for tuning in to Free Lunch. As always, you can subscribe on iTunes and Google Play to get new episodes of Free Lunch when they're published. Also, visit our website at regproject.org. That's regproject.org. There, we regularly upload content in addition to our podcasts, such as short videos and papers. And you can join the discussion by sharing your story of how regulation has personally affected you. Until next time, remember, there's no such thing as a free lunch.
This has been a FedSoc audio production.